supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Say the words, Three Mile Island, to anyone over the age of 50, and these voices may just come to mind.
An accident in the water cooling system at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, forced the company to call a general emergency and shut down part of the plant for an unspecified period.
The accident sent ionized radiation beaming through the plant's four-foot-thick walls. Consequently, the metal shield that protects the nuclear fuel may have been damaged.
I am advising those who may be particularly susceptible to the effects of any radiation, that is pregnant women and preschool-aged children, to leave the area within a five-mile radius of the Three Mile Island facility until further notice.
Conflicting statements from the governor's office, the NRC here, the NRC in Washington, and the company Metropolitan Edison that owns the plant.
I think we're very close to a chaotic situation. Part of it, I think, is a lack of credibility of what we're being told. Part of it's the confusion that's coming forth.
And it would seem to me that the core may very well be in the process of melting right now.
That's more or less the story of the dramatic near meltdown of the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant near Harrisburg in 1979, the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history. Those clips are from the 1982 documentary Three Mile Island Aftermath. Now, the operator of Three Mile Island has announced it's going to prematurely close the nuclear power plant in September 2019 for a much more mundane reason, a funding shortfall. If it doesn't receive additional state money, the facility in Dauphin County would shutter 15 years before its license expires. It's been unable to compete economically amid lower demand for electricity and a glut of cheaper natural gas. That's why the nuclear industry has been lobbying state lawmakers in Pennsylvania and elsewhere to create new policies to support the plants. Matt Weld is with the trade group, the Nuclear Energy Institute. He says the marketplace for wholesale electricity doesn't value what nuclear brings to the table in terms of carbon-free emissions.
But if you really value zero-emission electricity, you don't toss aside the existing assets that produce the lion's share of that electricity.
New York and Illinois recently gave billions of dollars in subsidies to the nuclear industry by essentially broadening the definition of clean power. But the bailouts are facing opposition from competing power producers, especially the booming natural gas industry. When Philadelphia's pre-K initiative began this year, it became the fifth, yes, fifth government-funded preschool program in the city. The federal government has a program. The state government has three. And while this web of money gives more kids access to early education, it can also have an unintended side effect, segregation. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron explains why and shows us a small experiment to try to reverse the trend.
There are a lot of reasons to make children brush their teeth. But here's one you probably haven't heard before. Diversity.
All right, Sonia, go throw away your paper towel and then you can come back and brush your teeth.
Every day after lunch, pre-K students at the Caring Center in West Philadelphia brush their teeth. You might know the effort it takes to get one child to brush. Now multiply that by about 20.
Now put it in your mouth. No, you can't touch. We can.
The staff here at the Caring Center care plenty about dental hygiene, but that's not why they go through this carefully choreographed ritual. Center's executive director, Justin Bell, says they do it because a 118-page booklet of regulations published by the federal government says they have to.
So brushing your teeth, vision screenings, dental screenings, all those sorts of things. Head Start requires that other programs don't, but we just sort of bake that into our program as a result.
Some of the students at this privately run facility attend for free, thanks to Head Start, the federal government's pre-K program. Others are subsidized by Pre-K Counts, a state-run initiative. Still others are here because their parents pay tuition. Now, Head Start comes with a lot of regulatory requirements. And if it wanted to, the Caring Center could separate its Head Start kids in a special classroom where all of these many rules would be followed on a smaller scale.
We could arguably have, you know, one class with all of our Head Start or Pre-Counts kids just by toothpaste for them.
And most Head Start providers in Philadelphia do exactly that. They have separate classrooms or even separate sites for students in Head Start. The Caring Center is one of the few that provides Head Start level services to all students. It's also among a relatively small slice of pre-K facilities that are so diverse, no race comprises a majority.
The diversity that we have means our children are set up to be sort of open and accepting of people of different faiths, people of different skin colors, people of different, you know, backgrounds of all types. And I think there's a lot of value in that.
If you're wondering how we get from brushing teeth to integration, you have to know one more thing about programs like Head Start. They're targeted toward low-income kids. Head Start is open to families who live at the poverty line or below. That's about $25,000 a year for a family of four. Pre-K Counts accepts families up to 300% of the poverty line, or about $73,000 for that same family. These income caps make sure the neediest kids get the most help, but they also create a sort of artificial barrier to economic integration by siphoning off the poorest kids and putting them in separate classrooms. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of clean teeth to mix kids from different government programs in the same classroom with kids from families who can pay full freight.
Pre-K is probably one of the last areas where children are actually economically segregated from their peers. And when you say it that way, people are always like, wow, I never thought of it that way. But that's exactly what happens.
That's Diane Castlebuono. She runs the Office of Early Learning for the School District of Philadelphia. Of the 166 pre-K sites either run or funded by the district, about half are either fairly or highly homogeneous, meaning that more than 70% of students belong to the same race. Some of that, likely most of it, is due to big picture phenomena like how racially segregated many Philadelphia neighborhoods are.
We're not going to change the residential segregation, but we certainly don't have to reinforce it in ways that don't need to be reinforced.
And so this school year, her team started a small, unpublicized experiment in Northeast Philadelphia.
Purple cat, what do you see?
It's a dog.
What color dog?
White.
It's a dog.
On the surface, it's hard to see anything revolutionary about the preschool program at Fitzpatrick Public Elementary School. Because, as Administrator James Cupid says, everything here looks almost exactly the same as it did last year.
I don't think there's lots of evident differences. Kids are happy. They're having their snacks. Everybody enjoying their snack?
But there is one big change this school year. Last year, Fitzpatrick's four classrooms were split up by funding source. All kids funded by the state's Pre-K Counts program were in a specific classroom. All kids covered by the federal Head Start program were in other rooms.
This classroom last year was a Head Start classroom?
This year, for the first time, all the kids are mixed together. Of the more than 60 pre-K centers run directly by the School District of Philadelphia, Fitzpatrick is the first where Head Start kids and pre-K Counts kids learn together. The hope is that it won't be the last.
And so the pilot at Fitzpatrick is an attempt to say, we know we want to get to, whether you call it blended funding or braided funding, to support pre-K. Let's try to do it.
But doing all of this requires effort and money. The Caring Center has administrators, including a part-time controller, to wade through all of the regulations. It's not a huge expense, but it's a sort of diversity tax the center pays annually. Castlebuono thinks the district could do something similar on the cheap if it spreads the cost out over dozens of schools. But first, it has to figure out how. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Registered New Jersey voters participating in the primary election 1 week from today will determine the Democratic and Republican candidates vying to replace Governor Chris Christie. NewsWorks Tonight continues a series of conversations with the candidates. Joining me now is Democrat Phil Murphy, former U.S. Ambassador to Germany, former finance chair of the Democratic National Committee, and former executive at Wall Street banking firm Goldman Sachs. Mr. Murphy, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Dave, I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations. Most recently, all the endorsements, and now Vice President Joe Biden, he describes this gubernatorial race as even more important than the 2018 midterms.
I heard him say that. First of all, I was incredibly honored by his support, and I think he stands for so many of the things our party and our country aspires to be.
If the election is nearly as important as the vice president was alluding, why then is turnout expected to be typically dismal as it is for a primary? I think it was around 12% in 2005 when there was also no incumbent running. And I'm wondering if the voters now post-November election are just fatigued of the entire political process.
It could be. We're hoping that we'll get a good turnout, obviously. I think there's a lot of frustration out there. People, as you suggest, particularly in our party, were deeply, deeply disappointed by November, and they're even more disappointed by the actual governing reality of Donald Trump. And you've got 7.5 years of Chris Christie fatigue on top of that. So while that may at one level discourage folks, we're seeing unprecedented attendance and participation, whether at live events or online or telephone events. So maybe we'll see some of that on the 6th.
Some would dispute that the Christie fatigue has been in effect for 7.5 years. Early on, he was praised for, in part, his bipartisan appeal. How will you, as a elected political novice, hope to bridge the gap with your fellow Republicans in New Jersey?
Yeah, I'd say on the early days of Governor Christie, he had a couple of things that I thought he did well, but I was never on that bandwagon. I never thought that he stood for the right things from day one, frankly. As it relates to how we would see working across the aisle, listen, I'm a proud Democrat, but we are stronger if we can get there together. So I, over the years, have always tried to find common ground with folks who may or may not be in the same affiliation that I am. New Jersey in its best days, I think, under leadership from both parties. You know, I'm honored to have learned from and gotten to know the likes of Governor Brendan Byrne, Governor Tom Kaine. So there's lots of examples on both sides of the aisle in our state's history where we were able to find common ground. And I hope I can be that leader if we're fortunate enough to get there.
Part of that common ground, though, frankly, has to come with the man who's not elected, South Jersey Democratic power broker George Norcross, and he was often supportive of many of Chris Christie's policies. Where do you see yourself coming to accord with him?
Well, I've gotten to know him as I have a lot of the other players in our party over the past several years. I'm honored to have the endorsement of all 21 counties in the state, and that's an important point to make. I want to be the governor for all of this state, and up and down, east and west, we're a state whose economy is busted. We're not growing and we're not fair. That evidences itself in different ways depending on where you are in the state, but the commonality is a busted economy. If we don't get the economy right, we don't get New Jersey right, and that means both growing it and making it fair again, and that's in every part of the state.
Not to get too in the weeds, but it's one of your primary planks regarding the economy. Describe what you envision as a state-run bank.
It's a simple concept, but I think it's got huge potential. Right now, whether you're the state, county, local municipality, school board, you collect fees and taxes and you put them in the bank until you have to pay them out for expenses. In some of those cases, particularly locally, the monies go into community banks, and we like that. That's a good thing. Community banks need to be strengthened in our state. But in most cases, particularly with the state's money, it goes either to big Wall Street banks or they buy commercial paper in big corporations. Hardly none of that money actually comes back to work in the state of New Jersey. It goes elsewhere. So let's create a bank owned by the citizens. It's been done once before in North Dakota quite successfully. And the bank would be restricted to only do business in New Jersey. We've envisioned student loans, small business loans, and small-scale infrastructure loans as the core elements of that lending portfolio. And by the way, at the end of the year, if it's made money, the profits come back to residents of the state or to the state itself to relieve things like property tax pressure, etc.
Thanks so much for making time for us on NewsWorks Tonight.
I'm really honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
Democratic New Jersey gubernatorial candidate Phil Murphy, and you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. For almost 15 years, a program called Healthy Newsworks has trained Philadelphia kids in the tools of health reporting. Now, despite the similar name, no, it's not related to this program or WHYY. From our health desk, Ann Hoffman has the story of two eighth grade reporters who got their big break last week, interviewing Philadelphia Eagles player Ron Brooks about resilience.
It's a school day, but Coughlin Kang and Jaden Williams didn't go to class. Instead, they're in the bubble at the Eagles NovaCare complex in South Philly, and they are pretty anxious.
I'm going to be a wild when I shake his hand.
That's Jaden Williams. He asked his friend Coughlin Kang how he'll feel when he meets Ron Brooks.
How are you going to feel?
I haven't shaken a person's hand in a long, well, not a professional football player hand in a long time.
Brooks appears. What the kids bring in nervous energy, Brooks makes up for in confidence. He's not that much taller than they are, but he has a real presence. The kids interview him about an injury he suffered last year.
How did you feel when you were carted off the field? What was going through your head at that moment?
All the money I had lost and about not being able to help my teammates for the rest of the season, right? Or not finishing the game, really.
The kids are part of a program called Healthy Newsworks. The organization's mission is to empower student journalists to transform the health of their communities. Former Philadelphia Inquirer health reporter Marion Ullman is the executive director. She says the curriculum includes a special topic each year, like prescription drug safety or heart health. This year, it's resilience. Ullman wants kids to move from nervous cub reporters to empowered citizens who can talk to anyone, from a public official to their math teacher, or even a famous football player.
And that they have the presence and the skills to be able to do that and not be cowed.
Back at the practice field, the kids are finishing up their interview. Brooks suffered a season-ending injury last October, so Kang, who is slowly getting less nervous, wraps up by asking about recovering from such a big setback.
So, in your own words, how would you define resilience?
Resiliency to me is just trying to accomplish something and not letting things stop you or getting away from accomplishing that goal.
After 15 minutes of a straight interview, Williams breaks character and tells Brooks how meaningful the experience was to him.
Yeah, good luck, man. I have no words. Like, I already know you're going to be on top.
Appreciate you too, man.
Ullman says in her experience as a reporter, doing something outside of one's comfort zone, like these kids are doing today, builds confidence. She says that moving forward, the boys will use this experience to propel them into the next challenge.
Where they will feel confident, and it can be something that's more routine rather than exceptional.
Tomorrow, Healthy Newsworks will launch their sixth book, Leading Healthy Change in Our Communities 2017. Around 120 kids were involved in making the collection of interviews with noted health leaders. For WHYY News, I'm Ann Hoffman.
2017 marks the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court case overturning state laws banning interracial marriage. The case was called Loving v. Virginia for Richard and Mildred Loving, a white man and a black woman who married in Virginia in the 1950s, even though it was against the law in that state. Over the past five decades, interracial marriages have become more common, but those in mixed-race marriages still face unique challenges. The Loving Project podcast features the personal stories of some of these couples. Craig and Donna have been married for 29 years. They discuss how they met through video dating.
I got a call from the dating service saying that Thomasina wants you to see her tape. I went there, I looked at the tape. They had a number and several people are on it. And when I put the tape in the machine and started playing it, there was this woman who seemed to be in her 60s. And she was saying, oh, I love theater and I love walks on the beach and things like that. And my name is Thomasina. And I thought, no, no, no. And I just threw the VCR into rewind and it rewound for a while. And I clicked play. And the person said that one of the first things she notices about a person is their enunciation. And I said, I like that. And it turned out to be Donna. And when I was looking at the video and looking through her bio, I was thinking, she's black, and I don't know, but she has an interesting background. She was in Belgium, and she's a theater major, and I think I'll have her give me a call and take a look at my videotape.
I had pretty much given up because although in your profile they would ask you, you know, did you have any preference in terms of race and things like that? And I checked, no, not really, because I had grown up in Europe and dated many different people, many different nationalities. But when I would go to contact someone, quite often they would indicate that they wouldn't date me because of my race. So I got frustrated and I just said, okay, enough with this nonsense. I'm not doing this anymore. And then I got a call saying, Craig would like to meet you. So I went and I saw Craig's profile, which looked good. But the only thing that's not on his profile is his height. I will admit I'm rather a height bigot. So I asked the woman, I said, do you have any more information on him? He kind of just made it, you know, at 5 foot.
5'9 3/4 and 5'10 was your cutoff.
Yeah, 5'10 was my cutoff. We all have something. You know, I think we've been pretty lucky. I don't think we've run into too many overt instances of racism. I mean, we have experiences, and I have a certain radar that Craig has developed over time.
There were certain things, like back when we were in Manhattan, and it's like, you know, I'm the guy who goes and gets the cab, she stays back on the sidewalk. You know, so you learn certain things.
Mm-hmm. He learned a lot that way. Yeah. It's like, okay, you get the cab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when we were looking for a house, it's like, maybe you should walk through the door first. And I think you got a little dose of what it's like to be a Black person through that experience. You know, even just having to think about that, which is not something you would normally think about.
No.
As a white dude.
It's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When we first had children, you know, my issue was, okay, what do I do with this white baby? Because she's so light.
And she had lavender eyes.
Yeah.
When she came out, it's like,
she's
whoa.
Really, but I mean, her skin tone was like almost translucent. It was really, really light. And one day I was sitting in the park with Chelsea when she was a baby. And some guy came up and he said, you know, she's really lucky. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, because she can pass. And I was just stumped. I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. I was furious. It was as if I was being strangled. I really couldn't respond to him at all. So I think I just picked her up and said, okay, let's get out of here. So, you know, there are little instances like that. And I can only wonder, like, how many people have thought that but not given voice to that kind of opinion. It really was not so long ago in terms of when we got together that we would not have been allowed to be with one another. I mean, it's hard to wrap your mind around that. The fact is, I don't think we'd be together. I don't think either one of us would have had the fortitude, the strength to combat and risk being killed. You know, personally, it might sound a little cowardly, but personally, I would have said, I love you, but I don't know that I'd be willing to have put my life on the line for our love, and that scares me.
Well, the thing is, I don't think it necessarily even would have gotten that far.
Yeah, we wouldn't have met.
We wouldn't have met, yeah. We probably wouldn't have been in the same video dating service.
No. No.
This story is part of a collaboration between WHYY and The Loving Project, a podcast produced by Brad Linder and Farrah Parks. You can hear the full interview, plus more stories from The Loving Project, and see photo portraits of some of the couples featured on the podcast at an exhibit opening Friday, June 9th at the Bill Russell Gallery in Fishtown. Details available at lovingproject.com. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.